So I can't remember when I was here, but it seems like it was recent, right? Is anybody here? When was I here? March. March, oh. And I want you to know that I have since finished my book. I know I talked a lot about my book when I was here, called Real Love. I finished it 7 hours and a year late, 7 hours early and a year late, because it was due. My last deadline was August 1st, and I turned it in the night of July 31st. I pressed send. I was very proud. Even though I was a year late, I was also very embarrassed. It was a fascinating process looking at love. It always is, I think. When I wrote a book called Faith, I was talking to a woman who's like a writing coach, Susan Griffin, who she's an amazing writer, she's not just a writing coach. But she was helping me because I was very, very stuck. And she said two things that were really amazing to me. One was she said, you've got to stop thinking of yourself as the person writing this book and start thinking of yourself as the first person who gets to read this book. It's like you're right there with the monitor, right, as it's appearing. So you're the first person to get to read it, but kind of take your ego out of the way, like, oh, I am creating this. And the other thing she said, which is sort of apropos to what I was just talking about, was she said, you know, a lot of people might assume you're writing a book about a topic like that because you're an expert and you want to impart your expertise. More likely, you write a book about a topic like that because you're really trying to figure it out. And the writing itself is somehow a part of trying to make sense of it or go deeper or have a deeper exploration. And so it is with love. I know it's the third of those skills that I talked about after concentration and after mindfulness, but I think it's really essential to everything. The term in Pali, the language of the original Buddhist text, is metta, M-E-T-T-A. It's usually translated as loving kindness, which is accurate and it's fine and I use it, but it's also a little bit, I fear, it's a little bit archaic or quaint or something. I've had scholars say to me, well, why don't you just say love? That's what you really mean. And so now I will, of course. But it's also very complex because certainly we mean many, many different things when we use the word love. Sometimes we really frankly mean a medium of exchange, like I will love myself as long as I never make a mistake, or I will love you as long as the following 15 conditions are met. And we know that state, certainly we know how breakable it is, how fragile it is. And that's not what's really meant by the term metta. There's something about metta as a term, that quality of loving kindness, that I think is not really based so much on circumstance. It's more like an inner resource that we sometimes bring forth in response to someone else or response to some situation. I think it has elements of feeling at home with ourselves, a sense of belonging in life, so that we don't feel so alone, so cut off. It has some sense of profound connection, which does not mean you like somebody. I may have talked about this last time too, but one of the, I had some great moments in creating this book, which were all offered to me by other people. And one of the great moments actually, which I remembered, I was in England just before I pressed send, and I remembered I'd left this out. And I put it in at the last minute, so I imagine there will be a few more changes coming. But that was a dog story where somebody said, and I'm doing an honor of our dog here tonight, somebody said to me in the first group I did to hear stories about love, he said, most people think of a good relationship as 50-50. My dog and I, we're 100-100. So here he is, cute, right? But the other thing that was really important in terms of my remembering, oh yeah, that really needs to be in there. And that also came from somebody, was I was doing a group and somebody said to me, my whole life I kind of thought that liking somebody was the easy thing, you know, that was like the, yeah, of course you like people, you like everybody. And loving someone was like a supreme, rare, unusual accomplishment. And he said to me, you're reversing it. You're saying we can love everybody and not even like them necessarily. And included in not liking them is maybe you don't want to spend any time with them. Maybe you're not going to give them any money. Maybe you're not going to support their action, whatever it is, right? But you can have the sense that you wish they could be happy. You wish they could come out of the suffering they're in. You have a sense of connection. You have a sense that everybody in their own way counts. Everybody matters. No one's to be disregarded or just kind of thrown away in some way, right? And he said, you're saying you can love everybody and that liking is a very rare phenomenon. And he said that to me, and I said, you're right, I am reversing that. That's weird. But I am, because that is what I think the human capacity really is not to like everybody or want to spend time with them or be with them, but to have that sense of connection regardless. So that even as we maybe take very strong action to try to stop somebody doing what they're doing, or we decide, no way am I going there, or whatever it might be, within our hearts, there is a certain sense of inclusion and care, right? Everybody counts, everybody matters. May all beings be happy in that sense. So it's peculiar, and it goes against most of our conditioning, and it needs to be really examined. There are usually two big controversies around suggestion or teaching of loving kindness or love. One is the idea, which is very prevalent, that these states are very weakening, that if you're loving, you're a patsy, you're going to let people just run over you, and you're going to let other people be hurt or abused, and you're not going to protest because, after all, you're being loving and sweet. It's like too sweet, you know? It's kind of saccharine. And that the cultivation of states like kindness or compassion or love will leave us very, very weak and kind of stupid, actually, that we'll be stripped of our intelligence and discernment. And the other great controversy is the idea that these states, assuming you find them desirable or interesting, it's the idea that they're trainable. In the East, in, say, Buddhist psychology, absolutely qualities like compassion are definitely considered trainable because they're considered to be like emergent properties of how we pay attention. You know, you walk into a store and you look right through that clerk. There's not going to be much sense of connection. There's not going to be much compassion that might arise out of that. But if you look at them and kind of feel their presence, and just like we did here in this meditation exercise, you gather all your attention. You stop thinking about your email for a moment, you know, or what the new Amtrak train should look like in 4 years. And you listen. And you're there. That's a very different quality of connection. And out of that, it's not like flamboyant or fancy or forced or any of this, like F words. You know, it's not phony. That's not an F word, but it sounds like one. It's because you're paying attention very differently that something else can emerge. And so we know attention is trainable. That's exactly what meditation practice is. And out of that, one of the properties that just develops automatically is caring. It's the sense of dissolution of the very rigid idea of self and other and us and them. There's much greater sense just naturally of we. We're kind of in this together. This is how it is, like it or not. And, you know, what would it be like? I saw a 7-year-old girl yesterday, her father, a mother briefly, and father mostly came to see me with her. Mother had to go to a meeting, but he was telling me about ways she was kind of learning meditation and learning to feel different in her school situation and other places. And one of the things he said they did was a kind of empathy game. Like if they were sitting opposite somebody in the subway, they would kind of look at them and each mentally just make up a story about what their day had been like up until then. And then when they were alone together, they would tell one another the story. And of course, there's no way of knowing it's true or not, but usually the story we tell is one of alienation. You know, in fact, I was teaching a loving kindness retreat years and years ago. It was a non-residential weekend in New York City. And so everybody went home at night and then came back the next morning. So this woman came back Sunday morning and she said, the evening before, she'd been on a train platform. I don't think it was a subway. I think it was actually like a train. And this guy started to approach her, and she thought, he looks really weird. And then he came up to her, and he started asking her something about the train schedule. And she was so freaked out, she just kind of randomly pointed to someone else on the platform. She said, I don't know anything about the schedule. You should go ask them. And he said, I can't go ask them. They look really weird. You know, so you think, like, how are we going about a day? You know, like, what is the story we're telling? And so here, it was almost like using their creative imagination to realize that maybe that person's in a hurry because they just got really bad news, right? Or they didn't have time to have breakfast and they've got to eat, and they can't afford much. They have to find a place that they can afford before they go to work, right? And so they were just kind of playing with the bounds of reality to remember that we all have some story. It's not really one of alienation. And we're not taking the time to learn it. Life doesn't allow us to. I mean, it would be a little weird if you went up to someone on the subway and said, I've been thinking about your morning. I wonder if you could just disclose, who's right, my dad or I, Although she was really cute, she might get away with it. But it's realizing that we can be either admitting what we don't know and or recognizing there is inevitably a story, and if we knew it, we might feel differently about this person cutting us off in traffic, or whatever it is, Because life's so intricate, it's so complex in those ways. So we see the ordinary habit of our mind, which is they look really weird, and we get to check it. It's not to say that you're going to take everyone home with you, or you're going to give them all your money, but we get to see the story and decide, is this something that's onward leading? Or is this something that is really kind of old, damaging, keeping me feeling cut off, and bringing me down? It's one of the reasons why, for example, in Eastern cultures, something like generosity is considered a very potent practice, because in a moment of giving, there's actually a lot of joy. There's a wish that the other be happy, the recipient. There's a feeling of letting go. There's usually a kind of delight. And often that delight can follow on a lot of fear. And so one of the things that we do is we say, okay, let's undertake a practice for a limited period of time. It doesn't have to be forever. But where you're going to engage in some kind of generosity. It doesn't have to be material. It might be thanking people. It might be looking at that clerk instead of looking through them. It might be paying attention to somebody talking to you in an elevator, which I don't know where you all are from, but in New York, it's like, that's not the way you live. and I've told this story in the Midwest, and people look at me like I'm crazy. Like, of course, somebody strikes up a conversation in an elevator, you talk back, and you have a whole chat. And I was like, no. But maybe for the period you're undertaking this discipline, you do respond, right? And you're present in some way. So it's some kind of generosity. So one of the things about material generosity is that it's very concrete. So you can monitor a lot just in watching that whole process. So one of the things we do sometimes in the community around the Insight Meditation Society in Barrie is we undertake these kind of temporary disciplines for fun, like generosity. So this was one discipline. If you have a really, really strong impulse to give something away, and it's not going to harm somebody, you know, it's not like, I think I'll give away my car, forget my family, you know. But you have a strong impulse, not like a little blippy thing that goes by quickly, but it's a strong feeling, like I want to give this away. And it's not going to harm anybody, give it. Even if the next 50 thoughts after the generous impulse are frightened. I don't know, I've carried that book for 4 years, I'm bound to read it soon. It's so close to the top of the pile. I mean, really, it's one of the few books I still have since I switched to Kindle after that third move in 2 years. But, you know, I better keep it. Or what if it's the very book I need for my next book? Because I may never write another book. In fact, I don't think I will write another book. Haha. But, you know, this is the one that would be the key, and I've given it away. How stupid is that? Right? Or I haven't used that in forever. I'm never going to learn how to use it, but maybe I will learn how to use it. Right? And so those are the thoughts of fear. So first is the impulse to give. Pay attention to what that feels like. And then comes all the fear. Pay attention to what that feels like. And then if you've undertaken this temporary kind of discipline, give it anyway. Pay attention to what that feels like. And what do you feel like afterwards? Do you really regret it ever? And that's the learning, right? There's something about an act of giving that reunites us with a sense of inner sufficiency or abundance. There's a kind of enoughness, an okayness, that even if it's brief, we come back to that. And that's why it's so joyful. Because we realize, I am enough, I have enough, there is enough, even without the book, you know, that I've been holding on to through all these moves. Or, you know, those stories, I do have tended to move, which is always intense. I mean, I live in Barrie, Mass. I have a house that never changes, but I spend big periods of time in New York City, and so I have been moving from apartment to apartment. I just saw a friend the other day who was spending a lot of time with me through, like, 2 moves ago, and he said, how long do you have this place for? Like, I'm not ready for you to have another move. It's too hard. But you know those stories, and I know so many of them, where people, like, put all the stuff in storage and they take it out 2 years later and they think, what did I keep that for? Like, that's stupid, you know, but I need it, right? In that sense of everything we think we need in order to be happy, or not even remember. I can't believe I kept that. That was a mistake. So in an act of giving, we are reunited with something that's whole within us, even if it's just for a moment. Pay attention to what that feels like. That's a very important feeling, because that is a feeling that is not going to be bolstered by how much we accumulate or what other people think of us or some kind of external accomplishment, as though, I mean, we'd be better off in the sense of it would be easier for us if all those things would make that essential, significant difference, because we're so used to them. But that's not how it all works. It's something about discovery. It's something about returning to that place. It's something about discernment. What are the places, what are the activities, what are the practices that help us return to that feeling that there is wholeness? Not that we have to make it out of our brokenness, but it's there underneath. It's just from being in some way. Those are the practices that we do. And that, in a way, is why we do loving kindness practice as well as a practice. Interestingly enough, in the tradition, you begin loving kindness practice with offering loving kindness to yourself. That's where it starts. And they say it starts there because that's supposed to be the easiest of all. The whole structure of loving kindness practice is designed to go from that which is easiest to that which is harder and harder and harder. So, of course, not everybody like fits within that particular paradigm, and it's really important to feel free to be creative and change the practice and change the order and do it in the way that's right for you. But the way it starts traditionally is offering loving kindness to yourself, because theoretically you deserve your own affection more than anybody else. And so that's the quotation: you can search the entire universe for someone who deserves your own love and affection more than you yourself, and you will not find that person anywhere. You yourself deserve your love and affection more than anybody. So that's different, right, than a kind of spiritual system based on self-punishment or self-abnegation. You yourself deserve your own love and compassion more than anybody. What does that imply? It implies finding the things that really make us happy. Not that we've been told will make us happy, or we've been lied to about what will make us happy, or the myths about what will make us happy, but using awareness, discernment, intelligence, examination to find out what really makes me happy. Like the act of generosity. It's not just being generous, it's paying attention. How does it feel when you're about to give somebody something and you think, I think maybe not? Now, Joseph Goldstein, one of my colleagues, tells this very funny story. I won't do it as much justice as he will, but it was a story about, is when I was writing this book, Faith, and he was on retreat, but also it was more like he was doing some reading and some writing on his retreat. And he came upon some story or some illustration which he decided would be perfect for my book, Faith. And he thought, I'm going to write her an email. I'm going to send her the story. And then he thought, no, I won't. I'm going to keep it for my own book. And then he thought, no, it's such a good, generous thing to do. It's like really good for her book. You should send her the story. And he thought, no, I'm not. You know, it's like, I deserve it. I found it. You know, she can find her own story. And then he thought, no, I should really be a good person and I should give her the story. And then he thought, he's very funny when he tells it, much funnier than I just did it. And then in the end, he sent me the story. And I didn't think it fit in my book, which is true. And I sent it right back. I said, thank you so much, but I don't think I'm going to use it. So he got the best of all worlds, right? He got the joy of finally being virtuous enough to give it to me, and he also got to use the story. But paying attention to all of that is the key, because then we know. We don't need someone to tell us, you know, when you're really driven by fear and the sense of, well, I better conserve it forever, is not going to be good. We find that out for ourselves, because we pay attention and we see that. We see that in terms of ethics or morality or the simplicity or the complications of our lives. You know, what does it feel like when you're in some mess and you're really worried and, you know, you're getting paranoid and who's going to find out and, you know, what if that person finds out I said that about them or, you know, and it's not in a kind of ranking of good or bad or, you know, even right or wrong. It's what is the consequence of living in a certain way? And is that a consequence we truly want to bear? Because when you pay attention, when you sit, as an example, or you do something that is very introspective, you inevitably do a kind of moral inventory. There's just the arising of these things, what you did, what you said, and they don't feel very good. There's that very beautiful quotation from the Buddha who said, if you truly loved yourself, you'd never harm another. Because, first of all, harming another is harming ourselves. And also, if you really believe that a human being is capable of more than mediocrity, you know, just kind of getting by and compromise, if you really believe we are capable of a supremely good life, then the things we do to counteract that or go in another direction are just very unfortunate. They're very painful because it's like we're ripping that possibility. And so it's painful. And we feel the pain of that. Very commonly in meditation practice, one does do that kind of moral inventory, and it doesn't feel good, but we can also recognize what we've done and move on, right? It's like begin again. Have that sort of resilient spirit, like, yeah, that really hurt. I don't think I'll try that again. You know, maybe I'll go in this other direction or whatever. That's better than just kind of circling around and being stuck with a negative self-image. But it's all from paying attention. And there's such tremendous care that we can develop for ourselves when we realize, like, oh, that stuff just doesn't go away. Look at that. I mean, how many of you have had an experience in meditation where something from your past came up? You can raise your hand. It's okay. Yeah. Yes. I was sitting this intensive retreat with his Burmese teacher, Sayadaw Upandita, who came to the Insight Meditation Society to teach in 1984. And I just got into one of those cycles where, like, sitting after sitting, some schmutzy thing I'd done or said, like, was appearing. It was like, and then I finally told him, we were seeing him 6 days a week for these individual meetings called interviews, and I finally told him, and he got really excited. And he said, is it going all the way back to your childhood? And I said, no, I'm sorry, it's not. It's not going back that far, you know, but it's just kind of, it's considered normal, as long as you relate to it appropriately, right? And that is to sort of see the pain of it, recognize maybe that's not a great direction. I think I'll try switching directions, and then being able to let go in some way. It's out of such enormous care and compassion for ourselves and a sense of what's really, I think it's like a breathtaking sense of human possibility. I can have a different kind of life. I don't have to just keep doing these things because I was told that's the way, right? And we have such a different sense of connection and care to others when we simply pay attention, when we're not cut off, when we're not distracted, when we actually listen and we make the effort. And it is an effort, it's like an intentionality to wish someone well. It doesn't mean may you be triumphant in your terrible deed, or, you know, may you vanquish everybody in your horrific effort to cause harm or whatever. But in that act of introspection, or those acts of introspection, we do discover that our own unskillful things really do come from a place of pain within us, and is very likely so too do other people's actions in that way. It doesn't mean you don't try to stop them, but there's a different level of connection that can and should happen. It's based on feeling that the sense of love or loving kindness is not a weakness, it's not going to bring you down, and it's something that can shift the energy of the dynamic that's prevalent. So years ago, I wrote a book called A Heart as Wide as the World, which only came to that title quite into the publishing process. I forget what the publisher was going to call it. They were going to call it something else, which I didn't like. But I couldn't figure out an alternative. And one day I was sitting in a retreat, and one of my colleagues was giving a talk. And she quoted this monk, the Sri Lankan monk, or German monk, really, who lived in Sri Lanka, who used this phrase, a heart as wide as the world. And I thought, that's it. That's the title. So I called the publisher, who was not that pleased to hear from me. And we had a conversation about it. And finally they said, okay, you really don't like that other title. You really want this title. Let's see what we can do. Because they'd already designed a cover and, you know, gone well into the process. So then they started sending me covers for A Heart as Wide as the World. This is a long time ago. This is 1996, you know. So I think they were actually sending them in the mail. And one day this cover arrived, potential cover arrived, and it was like from this Van Gogh painting. I can't remember which one. And because the word, you know, the phrase, like a heart as wide as the world, implies expansion, right? And kind of like openness and boundlessness. So it was a painting, it was the print of a painting of like a big, wide yellow sky. And down at the bottom were like these few crumbled huts, like the scene of total desolation, you know? And I looked at it and I said to someone, that looks like it should be the cover for The Grapes of Wrath or something like that. It's terrible. Like, when we were last happy to see like a big yellow sky? I don't know. Like, but I, you know, I didn't have that much confidence in myself. So I showed it to some friends. And I remember I showed it to one friend and she took one look at that and she said, this looks like a world that can use some love, which was a phrase that never left me, right? So it ended up not being the cover. We found a very nice cover from someone's like personal slideshow of their trip to India. But I really was, I was both moved and shaken by that phrase, which I've thought of many, many, many times since, including now. This looks like a world that could use some love. So what would it be like in the midst of everything going on? We just remembered that, right? That we can introduce that into our internal reflections. What would that look like in terms of our own actions or responses? We can introduce that in terms of whatever community. Maybe we can introduce that into our consideration of the world as we find it. And what would that look like in terms of our engagement and our action? And whatever we do, I am really confident that the energy we put into that exploration will not leave us with less. It will return us to that place of inner strength and resource that will help us continue on in that way. Okay, so why don't we do some questions or have some discussion? The great Bodhisattva of communication is going to run around with a microphone. And he'll even go upstairs. I've seen him do that. Comments, questions, anything?
I just have a question. Can you talk about loving Donald Trump?
It's hard, isn't it? Well, I mean, some people probably do. So I think those kinds of investigations are really interesting. I, first of all, would not make an assumption about any room and people's political persuasion. I have no idea who in this room feels one way or the other. When somebody really is a source of fear, for one, and you believe that their actions, if they got even more power than they had, could cause great harm, then it seems like the things we need to do are address the fear and see if there's an action we can take, however small it might feel, to actually engage in the situation. So they say the Buddha taught loving kindness meditation is the antidote to fear, which is interesting. You know, we think of it as something more love or loving kindness as something more like approval or something. And that makes no sense if you're, you know, filled with fear or you're really against what this person seems to stand for. If you think of it as the antidote to fear, then it becomes more interesting. Like when someone is the other in some way and we feel completely alienated from them and they're almost congealed into a characterization and we get more and more afraid, we lose the energy and the heartfulness to take any action. So the legend around the Buddha's teaching loving kindness meditation is that there were a group of monks who was sending off to a forest to meditate, and it happened to be a haunted forest. It was haunted by these tree spirits. And the tree spirits were not that happy about the arrival of these monks, so they tried to scare them away. So they came as these like ghostly apparitions and made these horrible shrinking sounds and stuff. And sure enough, the monks became really terrified and ran away. So they ran back to the Buddha and they said, "Oh, Lord Buddha, please send us to a different forest." And he said, "Oh, I'm going to send you back to the same forest, but I'm going to give you the only protection you'll need." And that was the first teaching of loving kindness meditation. So that's, I think, just an interesting thing to ponder. You know, what does it mean to cultivate loving kindness for that which we're afraid of? And it doesn't even have to be a person. People do it towards diseases, you know, toward parts of themselves they feel very ill at ease with. And it's an exploration, you know, so it's not that I can give you an answer, but I think it's an exploration worth having. Because there's something about the fear and the kind of rigid identification of someone as the other, which I think only weakens us. And it's an outrageous concept, but might actually be that if we can more have a sense of connection and care, which is not approval, that actually strengthens us in some way. And the other part is really, you know, like we tend to have a feeling of futility, I think, about small actions. And I think we have to challenge that. And basically, we have to do the good that's in front of us, even if it seems very, very small, because we don't know where it will actually go and how it will unfold. And if we don't do that, nothing will happen. If we do that, certainly there's a letting go process, but that's okay. You know, if you feel committed, if you feel impassioned by something, then engaging in some way is, I think, very important. It's more important than complaining, although I like to complain. You know, I'm culturally, you know, trained to just, like, complain. You know, so I say this to myself, too. You know, what are you going to do? You know, how many, in this case, how many people are you going to register to vote? Because I have a powerful, powerful, powerful commitment to voting. Not to say who one should vote for, but I know this is our voice and this is our right. And I was just saying in the car that I have a friend who I found out didn't vote. And now his son, who was turning 18, was not going to vote. And I just said, "You've got to vote." You know, and his statement, not to get too political about this, but his statement was that voting, whoever was in office, was not really going to affect his life, and the difference was marginal. And I said to him, there are plenty of people who live on those margins. You know, you may think it's not going to make a difference in your life, but he comes from a world where the shift in minimum wage by a dollar would make a huge difference, would have made a huge difference in his family of origin. And I said, there are lots of people who live in those margins. So if you think it's just a marginal difference, you vote for them. So that's my own commitment. And other people's may be different. And I can't say it's going to resolve all the ills of the world, but I feel very strongly about it. And so I know I need to do something more than just get on Twitter and complain. Voting in America should be mandatory, which it should be, like it is in Australia. But probably going to take something more than Twitter. I did a thing with Tim Ryan. I don't know if you know him, the congressman from Ohio. I did a thing here in D.C., although it's up on the web now. And it was one of the mindfulness conferences. And it was, I think it was supposed to be about mindfulness, but it all became about voting. And I was just saying to that audience, I said, you've got to vote. You've got to vote. And then Tim looked at me and said, are you running for office? And I said, no, you are. Yes.
I just came back from retreat at IMS. And it was amazing, so thank you for starting that place. And my question is, how do you continue your practice on a daily basis? I'm kind of trying to incorporate daily practice and not lose what I discovered on retreat.
Yeah. There are a few things. One is, it will be different than on retreat, so I wouldn't necessarily frame it in terms of losing it, because you're not going to be able to keep it or maintain it. Concentration is going to go up and down in a way that, you know, IMS, which is a fabulous place to do a retreat, it's so protected, and it's like they really have it down in terms of what would support somebody, and we don't live in that way, you know, day to day, but you know, even if your concentration goes up and down, you can be more aware. You can be practicing kindness. You can be practicing equanimity. But it takes practice. You know, it's sad for us. It's not like, it's like carrying, the difference between carrying your yoga mat around and doing yoga. You know, it's like you can carry it around. That's nice. But it might be inspiring for others. But, you know, look, she's got a yoga mat. But it's like you kind of actually have to do it. So some of it is seeing what's realistic for you. What can you really commit to that you can do? So I was talking to a friend once who was trying to learn meditation. And I said, what can you commit to? And she said, 10 minutes a day for a month. And I said, great. That's it. Somewhere in the middle of that, I read an article, some scientific finding, that 10 minutes a day for 2 months will actually change your brain. So I wrote to her and I said, I think you need to extend for a month. And she was fine with that. I was just with Richie Davidson, who's a neuroscientist at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. We were together in Milwaukee, and somebody was asking a question, something like this, and he was reinforcing the understanding from the scientific point of view that it's the everydayness of it that seems more important than like some great whole huge length. He said to me, because I'm so kind of identified with loving kindness practice, so much more even than like mindfulness. And he said, you'll be happy to know that the most recent finding was something like only like 8 minutes of loving kindness meditation a day will really like change you. It might take like 10 and a half of mindfulness or something. It's not that much really. I don't know that it's that healthy to go for the bare minimum, but if you think like 10 to 20 minutes a day, and if on some day you only have 2 minutes, you do the 2 minutes, right? So there's a commitment to a dedicated period of practice. Could be sitting, could be walking, could be lying down, whatever form, where you're not also trying to do something else in that period, right? And see if you can hit like 10 minutes as an average, right? And then there are what some teachers refer to as short moments many times. See if there are certain activities that you're doing anyway that you can almost like ritualize to either serve as reminders or as a time when just briefly you're going to be, you know, watching your breath or being in your body or doing loving kindness. So like that's where people use all those signals like let the phone ring 3 times without picking it up and just breathe. And then you pick it up. Or somebody told me once at in her office, like she's sitting around a conference table with people and they're about to have this big meeting. She'll look at everybody, like person by person, and silently think, oh, you want to be happy too. And you want to be happy too. And you want to be happy too. And then she watches to see if the tenor of the meeting changes. Or we say things like, if you're at work, look at your intention before a major phone call. Like, what are you really hoping to get out of this? You come out of this. Do you want to be right? Do you want a resolution? Whatever, right? So in that book, Real Happiness at Work, these are all under the category of stealth meditations. You know, so they're both. Now, I would say that I'm a person who's very committed to the benefits of that dedicated period, because I think the other becomes more and more hypothetical. Like, really, are you going to wait for the phone to ring 3 times before you pick it up? Unlikely, you know, but you're much more likely if you sat 10 minutes that morning, right? So it just makes the rest easier. And so it's like for once in our lives, committing to do something the easiest way possible rather than the hardest way possible. So then you see what helps me have a daily practice. For some people, it's looking at somebody, Mindy Rinpoche is another Tibetan Lama, encouraged his students to read like these new books on habit formation, and apply what they learned from that to having a daily practice. So that might be sit the same time every day. If you sit on a cushion, keep that cushion out. You can only walk by it so many times, you know, before you think, I think I'll sit. That's your visual cue. For many people, it's having some sense of community. That may not be every day, but, you know, being able to come to a place like this, even now and then, or people form their own support groups. I might have said this even the last time I was here. I'm actually, a friend of mine once said that he realized that if he wakes up in the morning and he turns right, he's at his computer, and if he turns left, he's at his sitting cushion. So 5 of us all together, including him, so it's him plus 4 friends, we form this support group for him. And every day when we've practiced, we send an email to the other 4, and the subject line is always turned left. And then if you want, you say something else, like, I did it today. I wrote, turn left on Amtrak. We're a very Amtrak-going crew, this crew. So someone's always on Amtrak. It's been a long time since I was on Amtrak. So, or you don't have to say anything because it's the subject line that's most important. Like any gathering of people, of any amount of people, few or many, it brings up everything. But if you can have a good sense of humor about your own mind, then it's great. So, for example, I've had a daily sitting practice for a lot of years. So for months, I was always the first one to write. And then I got really paranoid. I thought, oh, they think I'm showing off. They think I'm just like a goody-goody. So then I'd wait like 7 hours before I'd write, you know, or whatever it is. So you can have fun with your mind and everything that comes up, but you will find tremendous support in some buddy system. So I told that story. I teach an intensive loving kindness retreat every year. Last year, for the first time, to the gratitude of many, I moved it from February to May and in Massachusetts. And so I told that story, and I just saw this woman in Milwaukee who told me she'd sat that retreat, and she and this other person from that retreat have formed a gratitude group. So each night they like write to one another about something they're grateful for from that day. And I thought, that's so cool, you know? It doesn't have to be like a huge circle of people, but that's the kind of support most people need.
I've heard Jack Kornfield tell the story about when the Dalai Lama came and you were talking about the loving kindness practice and the problem that Americans have in bringing loving kindness to themselves, mm-hmm. which I think at first he didn't understand. But I was wondering if you would speak more or advise in regards to that and the difficulty that many of us, I know I, have in really making that connection, and also the difficult feelings that can come up in that mm-hmm. process.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So there are two things there. There are many things there, but in any process of meditation, and remind me of the first one in case I forget. In any process of meditation, like any process of introspection, any kind of inner journey, many difficult things will come up. And that's natural. It's inevitable. It's not a sign of things going awry or you're doing it wrong or anything like that. The entire question in this system of meditation is not so much what's happening, but how am I relating to what's happening, right? So joyous, beautiful, fantastic things may come up, and we may be so distracted we don't even realize it, or we may have a fixation on something else we think should be happening, so we kind of reject it, or we don't think we deserve it. So we kind of reject it. And really painful things may come up. It's natural. It's inevitable. We may fight them and hate them and feel ashamed of them. Or we may get too lost in them. This is all that I am. This is all that I ever feel. Neutral things come up. Just ordinary, like, oh, it's another breath. You know, routine, repetitive things, and we tend to zone out or numb out. And so the essence of mindfulness and training in mindfulness is relating differently to pleasure, relating differently to pain, and relating differently to neutrality. So in and of itself, the arising of a lot of painful feeling or memories or whatever, it's natural. How are we with it? And that's the training. Because nobody's that great, you know, to begin with. You know, it's really a process of learning. And with painful things, it is really both sides. We can get too lost in them and not give ourselves a break and be able to kind of refresh, you know, and then go back. Or we can just fight them too much. So that's a natural part of the process. It's maybe especially ironic in doing loving kindness meditation. Like in Burma, for example, or if you're, you know, read traditional, more traditional books about loving kindness, there are these 11 benefits that are said to come from loving kindness meditation. And in Burma, you recite them at the beginning of every sitting because it's meant to like lift your spirits and provide a context, you know? And so they begin with, if you do loving kindness practice, you sleep easily, you wake easily, you have pleasant dreams. But any natural process of introspection is a purification process. So maybe you had hideous nightmares, and that's good. You know, that's like a discharge of toxicity. But then you have to get up and you have to say, when you do loving kindness practice, you sleep easily, you wake easily, you have pleasant dreams. Really? You know? But both are true. Like, that's maybe a more ultimate result, and there's the process of getting there, which sometimes is very rocky. It just is. I think another cautionary note about loving kindness practice, or another irony which feeds into your first question, is that you will see the results. I think this is true of all practice, but it is maybe many-fold more true for loving kindness practice. you will see the result in your life, not in your formal practice. So you may not have that breakthrough moment of like, wow, I really love myself. But you'll be different. And it's kind of slow and steady, but it's definitely steady. When you say the wrong thing and you kind of recover much more quickly, like a billion times more quickly. Or you have to meet a stranger. Or a lot of people who are kind of in the public eye tell me this, and I experience it too, like if you have stage fright, I mean, a lot of people say this to me, they have stage fright, but they have to perform in some way, they'll stand there and they'll do loving kindness for the people in the room. You know, so then the fear may arise, but then it recedes and it's different. It's different in your life, which is where it counts. You know, so I think it's one of the ways we kind of punish ourselves is that we've got the meter running, you know, like, am I, you know, how much percentage more loving am I today than yesterday? You know, and we're looking at that 10-minute period and it may not have changed at all, but you will be different and you will be different toward yourself through the kind of just steady perseverance. If it's too hard to start with yourself, it's really not necessary. You know, tuck yourself in later. I have students who say they do loving kindness practice for all beings everywhere. And then they pop up like a pop-up ad on the computer. And it's fine. Me too. Okay. You know, have a sense of humor about it because it is amusing in the end. And it will work. It really will.
So persevere.
Yes, persevere.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we're out of time.